I'm going to introduce the podcast.
Do so.
Lady, gentlemen, and everyone else who is listening, this is the Castorbis Podcast with a K. Dear listener, my name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Castorbis.com. I'm also your primary host on the majority of these podcasts. With me this week is James McLean. James, how are you?
I good.
Yeah, James is this isn't the original James. This is actually the James ancestor who we've rescued from the tribal gum.
Tribal gum, complete with false eyelashes
and loincloth.
And loincloth, yes.
Yeah, thankfully, as we're not in the same room, we're only conjoined digitally. I can't see. So that is a relief to all. And indeed, dear listener, you can't see. I suspect you'd be more feared by that than I would be. So how are you, James?
I'm getting by.
Yeah, okay.
I'm getting by.
It's Monday here in the UK, isn't it? Today?
It is, yes.
So I'm looking out at a reasonably sunny day for this neck of the woods, and people wandering around kind of aimlessly, more aimlessly than usual. The majority of people where I live are kind of unemployed. So there's a lot of aimless wandering at the best of times, but today's a different group of people aimlessly wandering. It's mostly parents with their children and teenagers drinking for the time of day. That's usually they're usually at school. How about your end, James?
It's sunny out here. I'm trying to relax and enjoy a day off where, well, like you, I don't really have a day off. So there's always that pressure of knowing I really should be doing stuff.
Does it feel like a bank holiday to you, though? Does it feel like the rest of the world's having a bank holiday and you're not?
It always does. Every bank holiday feels like that. Because the grass is always greener, isn't it? But people think, if you work from home and you're doing sort of creative stuff, whether it's writing or artwork or whatever, you know, it must be great. But the downside is that you never really ever feel like you're truly taking time off, because you always feel there's something you should be doing.
Indeed. And in the case of Castorbis.com, it's thinking and talking and breathing Doctor Who.
Yes.
And drinking it, if such a thing was possible. Do you know, it's a surprise there isn't a Doctor Who aid drink yet. There seems to be a Doctor Who merchandise of every other type.
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't done some sort of Dalek aid. Sort of, I don't know, it's like Khaled juice or, you know, I don't know, something that would connect to a villain. Green, an luminous green drink or something that would be smaller.
Oh, it's bound to be green, isn't it? Do you know, they say there's an insurance company, I don't know whether it's a chain or what, near here called Colonnade, which I always break down into its colonnade. I was saying that's something that Hannibal Lecter would enjoy.
Yeah, that is quite nasty, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it just? Let's push on. The Crimson Horror was also quite nasty. It wasn't green, though, it was red. That's per the title, really. And featured the Doctor and Clara unusually becoming trapped and captured in the middle of an adventure, and we join the adventure pretty much halfway through with the Paternoster Street gang of Madame Vastra, Commander Strax, and Jenny Flint, and basically a bit of a romp of an episode, which has been received largely positively, and I was interested to see, because I did feel it might have been a bit of a splitter. James, how did you feel about the Crimson Horror?
Again, I go back to what I've said before. You can have a good beginning, you can have a bad beginning, bad middle, but you can't have a bad end.
You didn't like the ending, did you?
I thought the whole ending was... No, I'm not even talking about the coda, which was particularly trashy in terms of any subtlety or maturity. I'm talking more about the whole finale, the whole final act. I thought was absolutely abysmal.
Right.
Which was a shame, because the rest of it had been so tightly done. I did kind of feel it was either a bit of a vehicle for Vastra and co, perhaps a bit of a, could I dare say, perhaps a sulky vehicle, because he's always made it clear he wanted to do a spin-off of them.
We'll come to that later on, won't we?
Yeah, so. Even before we go into that, he's always said that he'd like to have spin-offed Vastra. So it did kind of feel almost like those episodes you get in American television where a spin-off occurs within the show, sort of like Star Trek had, was it Gary Seven? I can't remember, on Assignment Earth, they were trying to pitch as a spin-off. Mork and Mindy, you know, Mork appearing in Happy Days. And you get that it had that kind of feel to it. It's as if they were trying to, it was, the Doctor was in someone else's story a bit. But it didn't matter because it worked, because those people are quite good. And it played well. I liked the flashback, the approach to the flashback.
I thought that was really good, the way that was handled.
Kept it nice, fun, energetic. I just thought the villain just became stupid at the end. It just didn't ring true. And it just felt amateurish. It just felt, the movement of it just felt amateurish. The dialogue felt trite and embarrassing. I was cringing for Smith because it was just so pantomime. And
well, the whole thing or just the end?
Pretty much from when he takes the daughter to go and see the villainous villainous mother. And the revelation of Mr. Sweet. Mr. Sweet, I didn't mind that revelation. That didn't bother me. I know a lot of people have hated the cutesiness of the leech, but that didn't bother me. What bothered me was that the dialogue, her motivation felt like it came out of a comic book. It just all felt absolutely crap. And it was such a shame because everything before that was just so well done. It was almost like a novel. It was paced and segmented like you were reading one of the Doctor Who books. I could have seen that fitting so well into the BBC book range of the Eighth Doctor or even the New Adventures. Uh-huh. But I just couldn't get over the end. It's just terrible. And then, at the end, you have this awful coda, which just didn't get any better. It just felt like it'd been written by, I wouldn't even say a fan, I'd say a 7-year-old fan.
One of the Moffs kids, maybe.
Well, you know, hey, look what we found surfing the internet. And it's like, what?
Repeatedly.
I mean, it's not even like her name was necessarily, you know, if they'd sort of linked to a load of historical archives which had her precise name, I would say, okay, a bit of a stretch, why they'd be looking in the first place, but fine. But just a whole load of pictures. It just, you know, his history boiled down to 3 points of time, which just so happened to be the ones we've seen this episode.
Well, perhaps in the Doctor Who universe, there is a website called www.photosofmyaupairthroughoutheages.com,
which the Doctor seemed to miss when he was looking for her in his trek between the series. He found it a lot easier. So yeah, I just thought it hit a low that I've not seen before in the show. It felt tired, and that was very scary to see. It just felt absolutely tired, and so shocking on an episode that before that was beautiful. Dialogue was great, acting was fun, idea was nice. The locations were brilliant. I liked the way they did it up north. Got away from it always being Victorian London. I thought that was a smart move.
Yeah.
I couldn't fault it until that final act. You won't get me, Doctor. Ha ha. I'm going to pull my switch. Ha, I will stop you. No, you won't. Ha ha. And it's just, oh, God. what is this? So, yeah, big, big shame. Big shame for me. What about you?
I largely enjoyed it. I know what you're getting at with the last portion of that. I think the less said about the coda and the run into the Cybermen episode, the better, I think. I'm interested to know where the Doctor is going. I don't know if he went anywhere of any interest in the TARDIS after he dropped off Clara. But back in the 19th century Yorkshire, which I'm fascinated to discover that Yorkshire is now a city, apparently. I think someone needs to tell us. I'd better get outside and spread the word. But no, I like the setting. I like the bell glass. I like all that stuff. I love the sepia recap. I think that was near to genius as possible.
Yeah.
As you can possibly get in a 45-minute TV show. But that last portion, and you know, Rachel Sterling was magnificent throughout.
Yes.
And I think perhaps I can totally appreciate what you're saying. I think perhaps I was slightly dazzled by Miss Sterling, so I thought she was absolutely marvellous, as I say, throughout, and particularly in the last act. So, but as I say, I do appreciate what you're saying, and I can agree with you in some ways, but I don't think it was all that bad. It certainly wasn't. You know, I said it was a splitter. I was clearly wrong. It split us. I don't know what Brian would have thought of it. Brian, dear listener, is currently residing at the Tranquil Repose. Hopefully he'll be back next time. that's not a good place for him to go, though, is it?
Oh, no.
Uh, But yes, it split us. I thought it would be more of a Love and Monsters than it was, really, in reaction wise. It certainly wasn't as bad as, you know, it wasn't Fear Her. It wasn't that bad. So I think you're maybe overstating it.
Well, no, I still don't think Fear Her was bad, because I think Fear Her approached a mode to do Doctor Who which arguably didn't fit it. But what it did was consistent throughout. I mean, whether you thought it was shit throughout, that's entirely...
Well, no, Fear Her. No, interesting.
Oh, no,
I'm thinking
Love and Monsters. Fear Her's a pretty bad one. Sorry.
And yes, Fear Her, to me, felt tired as well.
Yeah,
if any Doctor Who over the last few years has felt tired, it was that. But I do think we have had a strong run of episodes this year, from the Snowmen probably through to Hyde.
But
Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS at a stretch. But at the same time, I do feel as though something's not quite right with the show.
Yeah, in what way?
I don't know. Again, it's probably stuff that we'll come to later on. It feels a bit smug.
Oh, that's interesting. You feel it feels more smug now than it has before?
Yes.
What's giving you these vibes?
I'm not sure what is giving me these vibes. It's only a realization over the last sort of few episodes, really, that there's really good episodes. You know, there's people out there who should be enjoying Doctor Who and seem not to be enjoying Doctor Who.
Yeah.
There's the decreasing audience, and I don't want to get too hung up on audience figures, because they usually write themselves with like delayed viewing and stuff, and there's this whole nonsense about sticking Doctor Who on in the summer.
Yeah.
Or the bright spring and the nice weekends and all that stuff. But then again, we've had those all the way back to 2005. We've only had one series in the autumn, and that was pre-daylight saving time. So, you know, I'm just about it all. And maybe, I don't know what the reason is. But let's get back to the point. We'll get back to the Castorba schedule as we see it, which I've lost. That's the... benefit, dear listener, of running your podcast with a email program that you closed by mistake. So, I enjoy the Crimson Horror. I like the title. I like the dialogue early on. I like the bit about the crimpling skirt and stuff like that when Mrs. Gillyflower discovers Ada realizing their mistake and all that stuff. I think it's a lot of fun, but I do think it suffers at the end and the coda kills it. That's it, really, I suppose.
I mean, it's not the only one that has ever suffered at the end. I mean,
no.
As I say, I mean, there's a lot have, but that to me, I really suffered at the end.
It possibly hits you more when it's had such a good setup as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I was impressed by it, and I think the mistake was, I don't think the mother and Mr. Sweet were really strong enough payoffs for quite an interesting and intriguing idea. And
because there was a lot of good ideas in there as well. There was like the factory, wasn't there, which was just mm-hmm. like some loudspeakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was brilliant.
Yeah. And it just sort of fell back into almost like a summer blockbuster finale. You know, you just sort of expect at the end of maybe a James, you know, an old 1980s James Bond. It just lacked any sort of depth to it. It just felt by the motion that the world was in peril once again, and this woman's got to be stopped. And she didn't. I just don't know. It just felt the wrong type of tone and the wrong type of motivation for where the story had been going. Somehow, it just it's hard to explain. It just was very unsatisfying. But it's funny how this series has polarized people so much. I am very genuinely surprised, because, as you say, by and large, I think the standard has been good. I think some of the script has been lacking, if I was to be totally honest. I don't think the last few episodes have felt the Doctor's been quite on par, quite as sharp in the dialogue as he has been previously. But that could be me. I don't know. It'd be interesting to do a rewatch and see how it compares. But yeah, no, it was good. I wasn't too sure about it at first, but by and large, yeah, it's a funny. It's such a shame, isn't it, when it goes like that? I mean, I know a lot of people don't like Love and Monsters, as I said, but one thing you can give about it is that it's consistent all the way through. What you see at the beginning is pretty much exactly what you get at the end.
And you're carrying a loincloth.
Yeah. So you can just discard it, something you don't particularly like. There's nothing worse when you have a story that you actually genuinely like but is let down, and that becomes more of the frustration. And then, as you say, you get ones like Fear Her, which just sadly were just bland. But then that had a very bad ending to it as well. That was just didn't work.
Well, that was the Olympic ending, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that was just I could see that being embraced by Russell for, you know, as some of those brilliant ideas, which probably when you get back to it, just you look at it on screen, perhaps doesn't quite carry the it just breaks the episode somehow. So yes, it was a show, but it was nice to see those characters back. So we did say at the Christmas special how good they were, especially Strax, and he was good throughout this one as well.
Oh, let's not forget Thomas Thomas either.
Yes, Thomas Thomas worked. It was a bit of an odd thing, the whole Tom Tom gag, but which I've only just got.
Really? What, just now?
Just now. Just you said Thomas Thomas, and I thought, yeah, I quite like Thomas Thomas. I like the Tom Tom gag. Oh, God, yes.
Never mind. Right. Okay. Well, we have plenty of other things to talk about in this week's Derbyshire podcast with a K. The shooting of the 50th anniversary has come to a close. Certainly, in terms of location recording goes, and according to a known name on Twitter, and I can't find the chap's details in front of me now, but they'll be in the show notes for this week's podcast. Shooting has ended. One of the places where they visited in the last few days was a place dressed up as a certain school, which we last saw in 1988's Remembrance of the Daleks, and previously in 1963's An Unearthly Child, Coal Hill School, where the head of the governors is one I. Chesterton. I bet you're excited, aren't you?
Well, I don't think it's going to be any more than that.
Okay.
I think that's going to be it. Yeah. I'd be very surprised if the certain I. Chesterton appears. And I think he should, but I doubt he will. But I mean, it's a nice nod, isn't it? It's an obvious nod, maybe, to some degree. But I don't think that's too bad, is it?
No, I don't think so. No, I think I'm right in saying that the headmaster's name was W. Coburn.
Ah.
Presumably a combination of Warwick Hussein and Anthony Coburn.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think it's good. We'll just have to see, isn't it? The 50th is a bit of a ticking time bomb in a lot of ways for a lot of people. And I'm sort of wanting it to be good, and I'm kind of scared it's not going to be. So I'm encouraged when I see little things like that, because I think little nods are important. But it obviously doesn't really define on how good the story is going to be.
Okay. Well, it's still exciting, nevertheless.
It is, yeah, definitely.
In addition to that, before we go on, if anyone out there can recall that when the 50th details were announced, we were told that there would be cinematic screenings in cinemas on the big screen, with it being 3D, etc. If you have any information about this, if you know of where this is taking place, if you've spoken to your cinema chain, etc., please get in touch with us. Leave comments underneath this podcast, or tweet me. Tweet at CastDerbysDW. You can tweet at Christian Corley, or you can email CastDerbys. That's Christian@CastDerbys.com, or just get in touch with any of the ways through the Facebook page, etc. Let us know what you can tell us. That would be awesome. Thank you very much. Now, we've learnt just today that the Christmas special is recording in September, which gives Matt Smith 3 or 4 months. We're in May now, so that's May, June, July, August, September. So he's got about 3 months for the film that he's starring in, How to Catch a Monster. It's about a standard length of time for a film, isn't it?
Mm.
So he's going to be quite busy over the next few months. So I'll be interested to see what their publicity he's doing at the end of Doctor Who Series 7B. So with that put to one side, how are we going to approach this next subject, James?
It's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is a difficult one, yeah. Do you want me to start or do you want to start?
I think it's something that's, it's one of those awkward things which is public domain, so needs, so it's open to discussion.
Yes.
At the same time, it's a difficult thing because it's very easy to allow negativity to start. I don't know. It can impinge quite badly on fandoms, and it can, and it is always very third party. So there's also a sort of slight consciousness of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, I think it's. I mean, I went to the website about this thing we're about to discuss, and I was looking at the comments. There's a lot of people just laughing it off, and I think there's probably a fair bit of truth there. Maybe it's perhaps not quite as much hyperbole as the comments suggest, as the article suggests, as a, you know, very big gloom and doom. But I think there's probably a few things there which are valid enough for us to talk about and not be seen as just being snippy or gossipy.
Okay, let's start this off by saying that whatever the situation is, and there's been a few rumours about what's going on behind the scenes with Doctor Who over the past few years, we'll probably find out the truth in about 15 or 20 years' time. So in some ways, what we're going to kind of approach, or beg pardon, broach now, might be just absolute nonsense. And it could be just obfuscation on something else completely. But, you know, going back to even... You know, this whole thing, which you may or may not know, but when Russell T Davies left Doctor Who, that was originally, the intention was that was going to be the end of Doctor Who. And I know you know, James, I'm talking to the listener. And the BBC wanted it to continue, which is why Steve Moffat was brought in. But Russell T Davies, that's why Russell T Davies and David Tennant left at the same time, because the intention was they'd agreed to end at the same time, and that was going to be it for Doctor Who, and maybe there'd be the odd special over, like, in an Only Fools and Horses sort of a way, which for our American viewers, listeners, that won't be a particularly relevant cultural reference to you, but it basically means having a Christmas or Easter special every so often. So Stephen Moffat has developed a reputation over the last few years by rumour. No one's obviously said in the papers, I'm not working with Stephen Moffat again, that he's become a little bit difficult to work with, or that he's always been a little bit difficult to work with. But then again, this is a man who has run several of his own shows. He's a writer. He's also a comedy writer. And he's a man with a lot of things to deal with. Family, TV, two TV shows to run, all that other stuff. And, you know, sitting here at a desk with, you know, a couple of features on the go. And then a quick trip downstairs for me tea and to see the family. I probably can't appreciate quite how difficult Stephen Moffat's life might be. Nevertheless, there is this rumour that he's been quite difficult with people. And some of these things have turned up in perhaps there's been rumours of Sherlock recording being put back, even though the stars themselves have said that they're ready and just waiting for the scripts. There's been Doctor Who split in two twice, and there's been rumblings from within the BBC as well. Again, these are rumours, but they're rumours that we've heard from different areas. James.
Yeah.
How do you feel about these rumours?
I mean, I've heard stuff from various sources myself, and, you know, a lot of them are sort of fairly negative. And by and large, I would say, without having ever met the gentleman, I would say there's probably a lot of truth to a lot of the rumours. Now, how you interpret the untruth is a different thing. I mean, the sort of whistleblowing that we're referring to, which was a very long, detailed breakdown of where this particular person believed from his experience, where Stephen Moffat was bringing Doctor Who to a very bad situation. I've heard enough to feel that there is actually stuff which allies with sources I've heard from other places. So I think there is some truth. I think where the article becomes dangerous is when you start subjecting those facts to subjective opinion. Like, for instance, there was one comment that he was extremely angry and envious because he couldn't do what Russell T Davies did with Doctor Who and have the control of the spin-offs. Now, he could actually be angry from that, from a sort of personal, from professional point of view, because he's got creative things he wants to do. He could feel angry because simply he feels that as the runner of one of the BBC's long-term flagships, which he has done a lot for internationally of late, that he should have that same sort of power. That doesn't necessarily denote his envy. So, no. And envy is a very, very tabloid term. And you can sort of break down what could be either professional hurt or practical frustration down into something which, you know, the Daily Mail would love to use, because you can just, because everyone hates someone who envies. So I think there's that sort of factor I think you've got to be careful of. I think a lot of the things in there probably were. I mean, there was another thing that said that there was a massive rift now between him and Matt Smith, because Matt Smith expected the other doctors to have been approached. And by and large, they haven't, by the sounds of it. Now, again, I wouldn't be entirely surprised if Matt Smith was pretty peeved by that. At the same time, does that actually classify it as a massive rift?
I don't think so, no.
Exactly. Well, you know, we don't know either way. I mean, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But you can't make that, and you can't make that analysis if you're trying to actually show people. I think that is where the points start to fail, because I think there's a lot of truth in there. But I think how it actually talks about the truth can actually misrepresent or put you in a position where you haven't got the right to represent. You know, you can sort of say, I think Matt Smith was, from my knowledge, very annoyed about Stephen Moffat. But then to actually say on Matt Smith's behalf that there is now a rift between him and Stephen Moffat seems to be a little unfair. Unless one of those two come out and say, actually, yeah, we've got to a point where we can no longer work. I think it starts to demonize. And I think that's always dangerous and perhaps a little immoral. Because as you say, Stephen Moffat runs a show. I mean, if he wants to be a dick, he can be a dick, providing he produces the stuff on spec as required. Does that, you know, in the same way I sometimes find, you know, people who get over focused on, you know, politicians' marital affairs, you know, and the like, and you start to think, well, how important is that? I don't know. Perhaps it shows an issue of integrity. But, you know, is that really why you're wanting him to go? Is it because of, I don't know.
I think perhaps with that is that we're told that politicians are extremely busy people. And the majority of us would imagine that having an affair is something that takes up some time.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps there's this view of, well, where do they find the time to be doing that? Shouldn't they be doing something that we voted them in for?
I suppose also there's, and we're going off tangent, is the argument that a lot of politicians at some point or another make moralizing or moral judgments on what we should be doing.
Mm.
Maybe not necessarily on marital affairs,
sure,
but they might make a moral point about criminality or, you know, scroungers versus skivers, and then to suddenly see them actually doing something which is patently immoral suddenly makes us feel that they shouldn't be there in a position where they can actually inform us what is morally or socially correct. So yes, that's going way off the point, but yeah, so I think it's a bit of both, isn't it? I mean, do we need to sort of break down some of the things that were said?
Do you want to start?
Well, I'm going off memory, to be honest. I haven't got it in front of me.
Okay.
The Matt Smith thing was one that I hadn't heard of. That apparently Matt was very upset that the doctors weren't involved, obviously apart from Tennant. Another one was that there was things said by Stephen Moffat, and I don't think it names another producer, Stephen Moffat, another producer, which were rude to in regards to Christopher Eccleston, which is why he pulled out at the very last minute. I mean, and it was the very last minute. They were just about to shoot, as I recall.
Well, I think they were trying to get away from that impression, weren't they, publicly?
Yeah. But it, as I recall, you know, when it came out that he was no longer doing it, seemed, you know, pretty damn close. I don't think many actors would be very comfortable of actually making that decision at that point unless they felt there was a real reason to, you know, I mean, that was unless it was obviously decided a lot longer beforehand. But I don't know.
No.
So, again, I can't comment on that. I don't know whether that's true. I know that I could imagine it being true. Now, what the details of the rudeness was, I wouldn't speculate on, and I wouldn't judge. But I'd imagine Christopher Eccleston feels if things which were said were inappropriate, I could imagine him taking the course of action of backing out of a deal. That's what I mean. That seems feasible. Whether they were actually rude things,
given the actor that we're talking about,
miscommunications, yes.
Yeah.
I would feel that he felt that there was something, I could imagine something being said being part of the reason. And again, it could be just part of a reason, couldn't it? It could be the fact he's got other things being asked to do, and that could just tip the balance and think, no, I'm not doing that. or he may have been uncomfortable about doing it anyway, and that just tipped the balance. So again, how you actually report it doesn't necessarily ally to perhaps what happened. What else was there? There was the whole Carol Skinner thing, which we talked about before, I think, with her leaving quite suddenly.
Yeah,
we found quite surprising. And it's a bit vague in the whistleblower, isn't it, about what it was.
The implication of an unprofessional work. Well, it says an unprofessional working relationship, which you can draw your own conclusions.
Exactly.
No, I think.
But again, you know, we haven't even got that to actually say for sure. But that turned into a public issue. Now, I don't know about that, so I don't know quite how public this issue was.
Apparently it was at a sort of screening event or a merchandise event or something like that. It was a press event. A sales event. From what I understand, it happened at an international screening, where companies from around the world, broadcasts from around the world, come and see what's on offer from Britain. And I believe that is where any public disagreement took place. Again, we don't know what the cause of it was, but there's supposed to be some disagreement which may or may not have led to Carol Skinner leaving.
Right.
And that's, yeah, I mean, there's a few other things. There's also the suggestion that the season splits were not down to the BBC, but due to Stephen Moffat's discretion, decisions that he's made. But they may have been caused by budget cuts, so to blame Stephen Moffat on those entirely is...
Well, I mean, I'd heard from a source, as I've said to Christian before, that there was a question of whether... Stephen Moffat was on time, script-wise.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that from a couple of sources, that there was times. And there is a point in there where it says there was a fair few scripts which were junked.
Yes. Basically, this rumour has come into public domain thanks to a BBC insider who may or may not be completely on the level with some of the other things that they've posted, and they've since apparently left the BBC. But they do tune in with things that we've heard separately over the past few years.
Exactly.
And when I say separately, I mean James has his own sources. I've got two or three of my own as well. And these kind of bad, vibey things come back to us. Now, as I said earlier, when Russell T Davies was in charge of Doctor Who, this thing about Doctor Who ending, coming to an end, that was mooted to me in late 2006-07. So that was, again, that was something that had come from within the BBC. So there are voices in the BBC that kind of make a noise and want to keep things very quiet about who they are and things like that. So we should not dismiss any of this out of hand. At the same time, we should be taking it with a pinch of salt.
And there are some perhaps the ones that we should be focusing on, thinking about it, is less of these, which are sort of slightly gossipy and arguably a little agendaed against Stephen Moffat, for right or wrong. But the ones which actually talk about the future of
which
the show.
Which is where I was coming to.
Yeah, sorry.
As I'm sure you knew. Which is this sort of implication that the BBC want a different executive producer.
Yeah.
Now, this may be because of all of these things which we've just talked about, which may or may not be true. Or it might be just because they feel that the time is right for a new producer.
Well, I mean, again, I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, we've had various different sources which have suggested to us that there's been a lot of unhappiness within the production and above the production. And at the same time, there's been a lot of happiness in so far as the fact the show has been internationally successful at the very least.
Yeah.
Especially in America. I don't think we can argue that a lot of that has to do with the BBC and Stephen Moffat's push into America in season six.
Yeah, I think at the same time, though, BBC America and BBC Worldwide have had a massive part to play.
Yes, okay, yes, fair enough. I'm trying a little too much to not seem a little unfair to Stephen. But these rumblings have been going for a while, and sometimes have sort of surfaced in things. It was about a year ago, Christian. Do you remember Private Eye?
Yes, seeming to
infer that there was a bit of a split between BBC London side and Cardiff, particularly Moffat. I'm trying to recall what the issue was. Was it over the future?
I think it was something to do with one of the splits.
It was to do with the next season, you know, because there hadn't been a date. There hadn't been any confirmation of where the show was going.
Of course, that's right. Well, again, we're in that situation again now as well.
Yeah.
No Series 8 has been confirmed as yet. But we know that writers have been invited to it. So it's not like it's off the table.
Well, the article suggests that the situation is, and I've heard other people sort of bring up the same worrying concern is that the show isn't going to go into another, there's no sign of the show going into another series. It's not saying that there is going to be no more Doctor Who, and this article doesn't say that either. It says that Stephen Moffat is the only person at the moment who is pushing Doctor Who on the premise of another series. The actors are on board on the on a pro rata basis. It's not on a contract, and BBC still hasn't greenlit doing a series 8, and it's just up to Christmas. And at this point of time, that is considered to be quite unusual for the BBC to be in this position at this time in the scheduling. And other things have been announced, but nothing on Doctor Who's future has been announced in the form of a series. And I think that's what I think the thing we've got to nail down.
If we go back over the last few years, the only time Doctor Who's been announced, the only time a Doctor Who series has been confirmed whilst another series has been on air was in 2005.
Right.
That's not something that anyone should get concerned about at this stage. If this is still the stage, if this is still the state, the situation in like 3 months' time, taking into account what happened last year, then yeah.
But I mean, I'm not very au fait with the way the BBC works, but from what I understand, how the commissioning system works in the BBC,
there would be internal knowledge.
Knowledge. I'm talking about that's public announcement. Yes, yeah. But the point what I've heard is that there is no internal decision on it, and I think that is where the slight concern is. And as you said, the article suggests that the BBC have offered another position to Stephen Moffat, and he turned it down to stay on Doctor Who. And I think this is probably quite true. I could see that there's probably some truth in this. I get the Private Eye expose seem to be quite telling from an outsider's point of view, that there seems to be a schism between what BBC wants and maybe what's happening in Cardiff. And I do think there might be some issues there which are causing some abrasiveness, maybe. And as I say, I've heard from other sources that people in the BBC have not been over keen on Moffat, but at the same time, Moffat has been delivering the goods, especially with Sherlock.
Yeah.
So there could be a situation where no one wants to take that step to try and change things, or it could be that BBC Wales is very happy with Moffat and it's the larger hierarchy which has an issue. And BBC Wales is quite, I mean, he's doing wonders for BBC Wales, really. So it is all very much in the air. It is all very much a dust cloud. And I think there are definite objects in that dust cloud. But I think it's, you know, I think you've got to be cautious not to over worry.
Yes. It's a case of not overstating, not over worrying, but being aware that change is probably afoot.
I mean, politics in anything, in any big organisation, you're going to get politics and you're going to get abrasion, you're going to get issues. So this isn't surprising. I mean, in the sense, it's quite normal. And of course, the longer the production goes on, the more chances that these politics are going to occur, because it's more time for politics to become uncomfortable.
It's bad that it should be happening this year, though, isn't it?
It is a shame.
Yeah.
It is a shame. I agree. And I personally don't think this has been handled very well. I mean, we've had Sylvester McCoy sort of make that very pointed comment that everyone in the world wants the other doctors in this except people producing the show. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of discomfort. And so I wouldn't be entirely surprised if some of that is in the BBC as well. And
I mean, forget about Time Crash, which was, you know, it was for charity. Yeah. Isn't there a very good reason not to have old actors? And you know, I love them all, yeah, but isn't there a very good reason not to have them in it? Is there not a chance that, regardless of who they are or how old they are, that doing that can damage the show in some ways?
Yeah, I think that's a strong point. As I've said in a previous podcast, I think the big mistake was Moffat actually alluding sort of slightly coyly to the possibility that there was going to be. And whether that was taken out of context, the comment, it was about a couple of months ago, wasn't it, where he sort of suggested it would be very nice to have all the doctors. And maybe he felt at the time having Eccleston on board and Tennant would sort of marry up to what he was suggesting. And now obviously Eccleston's pulled out. That's not looking quite as exciting. And maybe that's probably the problem. This is that he's unfortunately put forward an idea which he now can't live up to. And that's going to cause a lot of sourness for the 50th. I don't know, maybe then the part of me says this is the 50th, this is 50 years, you know. It, maybe in a sense he is wrong, maybe in a sense that this is, you know, we're celebrating 50 years of the show, and every year of that 50 year is important in some way. And is, you know, being 50 years of the show, maybe there is an argument that the 50th anniversary should be making sure that every, you know, each year of that 50 is important. Maybe it does need celebrating. Maybe, as you're right, it does cause problems for the show, but maybe it needs to. Maybe because this is, you know, like a last chance for a lot of these actors. I mean, Tom Baker's not getting any younger.
No.
None of them are getting any younger, believe it or not. This was a golden opportunity. And as we've said before, maybe a way of celebrating the wonders of the 50 years which haven't had the television. And we're talking about Paul McGann here, Sylvester McCoy, and you know, even perhaps some of the writing team. I don't know. I just kind of feel split on it, like you. In some ways, I think maybe he knows what he's doing. He's doing a 50th anniversary. As we've said, he's got Coal Hill School in there. He's got David Tennant in there. It's not like he's not paying homage to the past. So maybe we should just shut up and let him get on with it.
Well,
I'm Time War. That's being referenced in some way by the looks of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. And, you know,
there's Zygons.
There's Zygons, indeed. And maybe we should just let Zygons be Zygons.
Very good.
Oh, dear. No, but seriously, though, I think, you know, this is basically what we've just done, lady and gentlemen and dear listener, is just give you an appreciation of, like, an appraisal of what's been possibly taking place, the sort of rumours that are going on, and, you know, you can make of them what you will. Let's leave them there, though.
Yeah.
James, have you been watching anything Doctor Who-y that wasn't the Crimson Horror in the last few days?
No, but I have been very, very anal, and I was looking today. There's a great website out there, if you guys have not seen it and you're into the props of Doctor Who, called TARDISbuilders.com, and I was just reading a fascinating...
Is Brian on it?
He isn't.
Oh, right.
As far as I'm aware. But
you need to sort that out, guys, at TARDISbuilders.com.
Some of the history, the detail, the history of the prop. I mean, you'd want to scream out, you know, that is so sad how detailed some of the analysis is, especially. Mm-hmm. I was reading, it's like a 22-page, you know, forum page analysis of the original police box exterior and the changes that went through. And while it is, you know, you think, oh, God, it's just so stupid, why are people analysing it? There's something so cool about it as well, that people have taken the time out to... you know, because it's still history in a weird way. It's minimal history, but it's history relevant to what... It's interesting, not so much for the prop, but it's interesting to see how the people handled the props and how they tried to keep them working, how they tried to literally prop them up. So yeah, I've been looking at that today, and fascinating stuff on there by, you know, great fans who just love the show and love building from the show and do some amazing things. And I'm sure if Brian was here, he'd be readily agreeing with me that it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But yeah, beyond that, and Doctor Who, I've really not been watching much Doctor Who. What have you been doing?
Well, I received the DVD for The Mind of Evil.
Oh, lucky sod. You lucky sod.
So, and not having watched it in its entirety in the past, I only watched the first half of it. I think, is it the first two? Was it the third or fourth episode that was missing? I think I watched it up to whichever episode was missing. And maybe one of the others after that. I've been enjoying that over the past few days, and I haven't watched it all yet. I think I'm halfway through. But lovely, lovely serial.
It is. It's one of, I still call it one of the best ones of John Pertwee's. It's got almost like a modern approach to story writing, which you just don't see in Doctor Who. It carries two plot arcs, which, you know, obviously marry later on. But you don't really see that in Doctor Who, not to the extent that it does in Mind of Evil. I'm very envious. Did it get a DVD release, did it? It must have.
It's not out yet. It's out, I think it's out in June.
But the special edition is out. What I'm saying is, I remember it got a VHS release.
I don't think it's been out on DVD, actually.
No, I don't think it has. I think I'd have bought it if it had.
No, it hasn't been out on DVD.
No. Surprising, isn't it, actually?
It's interesting to know that the episode one's been manually recoloured by the guy from YouTube, Babel Colour, who's really called Stuart Humphreys.
Oh, I've seen, yeah, his stuff's good.
And episodes 2 through to 6 have been restored to colour via chroma dots.
Yeah.
This is the one that they had a bit of trouble with, isn't it? So I wonder if the reason that they've used Babel Colour for the first episode is because the chroma dots weren't working.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to find out. Because I remember they were talking about, I think we were talking about Mind of Evil at the Doctor Who convention last year, the official convention in March last year.
Did you, how did you find the Babel Colour?
Absolutely indistinguishable.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, I was thinking it was a later episode that must have been recalled. I was waiting for a drop in quality or something noticeable. Go on.
Do you think, in a sense, I mean, I remember when I watched it, I actually liked the black and white episodes and I saw it on VHS because, it, I mean, like with the claws of Axos, in a way, black and white hides so many.
I think it's probably most successful in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, isn't it?
I've never seen it.
Have you not?
No, I've not. I keep meaning to. I recently, a few weeks ago, listened to the audio version, which was the first time because I'd never even read it.
Right.
But no, so carry on. You want the black and white because of the monsters.
Because of the monsters, yeah.
Yeah.
They're not very good CSO, but black and white kind of, certainly black and white film, it is more forgiving on special effects, isn't it?
Definitely.
Or certainly on stop motion anyway. And they're kind of a rudimentary stop motion approach, and then you've got the little pterodons as well that attack Sarah Jane. So they look much better. They're more Mylock-ish.
Why did they ever consider at that time to do Invasion of the Dinosaurs? I mean, why? I mean,
it's the early 70s, but then you can maybe if you compare it with the Jurassic and think, well, that's your last attempt at it. Maybe it really wasn't a very good idea.
I just kind of think it's a sort of plot that I wouldn't imagine this series to even dare do, because it's, I mean, I know they've done the spaceship, but yeah, that was actually quite enclosed and easier to pull together, I think. But to actually do a citywide invasion of the dinosaurs for London in contemporary day is really a big I just think so many producers these days would go, oh, sod that.
I think probably the secondary plot about the whole kind of the plan to fool these people
in the space, yes,
who think they're in space. I think perhaps because it's got that, it gets away with it a bit more. If it was purely about dinosaurs,
yeah,
I think we'd be looking at a very ropey number, in my opinion, anyway.
Yes, no, I think you're probably right.
And the only other thing Doctor Who-related I've been watching is the David Tennant, the politician's wife.
And have you found that?
To be honest, I've only seen the first episode so far. I've still got the second one to watch on iPlayer.
You're not marginally sick tonight of
David Tennant? Oh, yeah. Well, you see, he always ends up along. He's a name, isn't he?
Oh,
and
yeah.
He always attracts other names. So even if I was sick of David Tennant, and, you know, I was more sick of him in 2009... than I am at the moment. At Christmas 2009, I was a lot sicker of him then than I am at the moment. At the moment, no, I'm not sick of him. I think he's attracting some very good people into the shows that he's working on. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. And, you know, Emily Watson's in it, so she's a very good actress. So she makes a good reason to watch it on alone.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to argue with it. He just does seem to be absolutely everywhere, and I'm beginning to wonder.
Are you beginning to take it personally?
The next time I open my drawers to pull out my socks, whether his face is going to be gurning some advert for Richard Branson at me. Because he's just everywhere, isn't he? And he's on every cover. And I'm pleased, to be honest.
Is he still doing those adverts?
I think he is. Okay. He's proof in the pudding that, you know, you can go on from Doctor Who and, you know, a good tenure on Doctor Who. I mean, Eccleston only did the one series, and actually your career can blossom. So yeah, good on him.
Indeed. Probably the only other thing to talk about then is what I've received. Now, I've not yet reviewed it because I'm still reading Steve Cole's 10 Little Aliens. as part of the 50th anniversary collection, which I'll be reviewing on Casterbus or on the podcast at some point, is Harvest of Time by esteemed author Alistair Reynolds.
Yeah.
Fell into my lap a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And it's complete with the beautiful 50th anniversary logo. Stephen Moffat, you playing at? and a glossy cover, a very glossy dust cover, dust jacket. And I'm just going to take it off, see what's underneath. It's just pale blue underneath. Now, I make a point of it being glossy because the previous big releases of this sort, there's J.T. Colgan's Dark Horizons, Dan Abnett's The Silent Stars Go By, Coming of the Terror Files by Michael Moorcock, and, of course, in the same range, there is Gareth Roberts' adaptation of Shada. None of them have shiny covers like this one does. They're all matted covers, and I do like the matte cover effect. But this is a shiny cover, and it actually feels like a standard Alistair Reynolds book with the shiny cover. Mm-hmm. So it's called Harvest of Time, The Master and the Third Doctor. Come on! I'm thoroughly looking forward to reading this once I get to the end of Ten Little Aliens. And once I found my copy of Jingo by Terry Pratchett. If anyone has seen it, could you tell me where it is, please? Because I need to finish it. Thank you.
I think it's, I have to say the 50th merchandise, the 50th range of books, I think they've got fantastic covers. I
They've
really
been beautifully
love those.
Designed, yeah.
Yeah. Stunning bits of minimalistic. It's beautiful. They look absolutely beautiful. I wouldn't want to buy one to ruin them. You know, they're just gorgeous.
Yes, they are. They look very nice as well. And they also, because they're all, you know, you don't get this with other Doctor Who book ranges. Even with this range of hardbacks, they're all different paper formats and different sizes. And now we've got sort of a slightly different cover and a different cover logo because it's the 50th. But with these 50th anniversary range of books, you can leave them standing in any order. You can leave them laying around just randomly and not worry about the fact that they're not in the right order, even though most Doctor Who fans would, you know, rather cut off an arm than have their books in the wrong order. These books can sit in the wrong order because they just all look beautiful and perfect next to each other.
Yeah, they do.
So, as far as I'm aware, that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K.
So it do.
So I would like to thank you, dear listener, and you, Brian Turnover, if you're listening this week, get well soon. James, do you have to any goodbyes? Shout outs?
No.
In the area?
Nope. They can all get lost for all I care.
Okay. Apart from that one over there.
Especially that one over there.
Oh, dear me. So, dear listener, thank you for listening to this week's Casterbus podcast with a K. We will be back next time, hopefully with a fuller repertoire of acts other than myself and James. But until then, enjoy Doctor Who next week, and bye-bye. Is that Santa I can hear there, James?
Is that a what?
Was that Santa I heard? Or was it an angel getting his wings?
That?
Yes.
It is. I'll leave a gap unless people want to actually guess. What it actually is, because I doubt you will have guessed, it's a quill pen with a golden nib. And it has the engagement ring of a friend of mine. I'll be impressed if you got this. Who left his engagement ring when he broke it off in his room at his university dorm. And then I happened to cohabit. I happened to take that room the next year, not knowing it used to be his, found this ring on the wall, and I took it. And it was actually one of my closest friends in my class's ring. And it was a very weird and bizarre situation of coincidences. But I kept it because of it. And so, yes, if you got that right, that it was a quill pen, a nib pen with an ex-engagement ring of my friend's being spun on the midsection, I am very impressed.
And you've just won this week's Casterbus prize of $1 million.
Yes. So that's what it was. Sorry, dear listener. And I think I've totally derailed. Where were we?
It's all right. We'll stick it at the end.